We're talking about Ohio Supreme Court Justice Pat DeWine again on This Week in the CLE, the news podcast discussion from Cleveland.com and The Plain Dealer. Still can't believe he has not recused himself from his father's gerrymandering case, and we've done some research to see how unusual it is. I'm Chris Quinn. I'm here with my colleagues Laura Johnston, Layla Tassi, and Lisa Garvin, fresh off a mid-October weekend. I hope you're all refreshed and ready to work.
Oh, yeah.
Always.
Crickets.
I almost need a day off to recover from all the stuff I did on that October weekend. So let's get rolling. Now that we've done the research, how unusual is it for Ohio Supreme Court Justice Pat DeWine to refuse to recuse himself from a case in which his dad is a key player? Laura Johnston, the gerrymandering case, there's three lawsuits. They're the big news story in Columbus these days. And Mike DeWine, the governor, is a key witness, likely to testify, likely to be deposed. And his son is sitting on the case, as we've discussed. Has that happened ever before in any court anywhere in Ohio?
We can't find another example of this, so it might be unprecedented. And Corey Schaefer did a pretty exhaustive search. He set out to find a case where the Supreme Court's Chief Justice considered whether a judge at any level should be allowed to preside over a case in which his parent or child was a participant. He looked through dozens of cases. He talked to experts. He talked to lawyers. He talked to the Supreme Court themselves, and they were pretty much, most of them were no comment. Some said, you know, you should really look for newspaper articles or something, you know, like he's going to go back through the microfiche. But he couldn't come up with a single example whether the high court was asked to decide whether a judge can pass judgment on a close family member. And the thing is, the judicial code of conduct requires state judges to recuse themselves from hearing cases involving close family members. That does not apply to the Supreme Court justice. And under the court's internal rules, recusal is essentially up to the judge himself. So there's really no way to stop Pat DeWine from ruling on these maps, approved in part by his father, who's one of the seven members of the committee.
Yeah, you can't do anything ahead of time, but the judicial canons still apply to Supreme Court justices. It's interesting, the Chief Justice can remove any judge in any lower court for doing what Pat DeWine is doing, but her power stops with her fellow justices. But it's still a violation of your legal ethics, your code of conduct for lawyers to do this. So if he persists in continuing, there's almost certainly going to be a case made that he should lose his law license for this. He's not allowed to do it, and yet he persists. I guess I was kind of surprised that we could not find another case because, you know, we always see misbehavior by elected officials. On the other hand, I'm not that surprised because judges know, down to the municipal court level, I can't rule on cases involving my dad. I mean, it's just an automatic. So the fact that no one has tried is a good sign. What's sad is that the Supreme Court justices are the highest level of judge in the land, the ones that are supposed to set the example. And here we have Pat DeWine setting the worst kind of example.
You know, obviously, judges are not supposed to rule on anything that they have a conflict of interest on, you know, whether it's business contracts or maybe issues in their own town or whatever it is. The thing is, the most clear cut of those would be your dad, your kid, your brother, your sister, you know, somebody who's that closely related to you. That seems like a no-brainer, not a gray area. There were a couple cases that Corey dug up that were similar at a much lower level. In 1989, then Chief Justice Thomas Moyer, he decided not to disqualify a county common pleas judge in Cuyahoga County because he was the son of a prosecutor, but he did end up removing him anyway because all the other judges might be trial witnesses. So that one was kind of moot. And then in 2009, Judge Leslie Ann Celebrezze was ordered off a divorce case because her dad had previously presided over the case. But those are different, but they involve, you know,
parent-child
issues.
But think about that. She was removed because some years earlier, her dad had issued a ruling on the case. And she was removed. But Pat DeWine will be considering his father's depositions, considering his father's truthfulness. He's already participated in an order to have his father deposed. That's a lot more direct than the Celebrezze example.
I agree. To me, it does seem like a no-brainer. And, you know, we talked last week that the Republicans are trying to muddy the issue by saying, you know, Jennifer Bruner should be recusing herself, which is ludicrous.
Yeah, that was such a stupid smokescreen. Nobody bought that. The thing I've been wondering is, to really show how stark this is, I wonder if we should find three really good legal minds and do a special episode of this podcast to talk about just how egregious this is, to have a forum where people can come and hear people in the legal profession talk about this is just not acceptable, especially for a Supreme Court justice. I don't know. We'll have to figure it out.
I think we'll have to get out of state people to do it, because Corey couldn't get people to talk on the record about this, because I think nobody wants to get involved because they don't want to cross the Supreme Court justice.
Although law professors could talk about it, and they're the ones that teach future lawyers about the code of their profession. And there's probably some retired prosecutors out there that could speak to it. I mean, if Tim McGinty weren't brought back as a visiting judge recently, I bet he would have talked about it. I mean, it's just so wrong, and he's standing firm. I don't understand where he's coming from. I keep going back to, they must just be so drunk with power that they cannot have any self-awareness of how they're being perceived. I have yet to hear from a single person who defends this. I mean, there's nobody that has stood up and said, no, I don't think there's a conflict of interest here. Everybody who's talking is stunned that he's steadfast in this. Check out Corey's story. It's on cleveland.com. You're listening to This Week in the CLE. How has Cleveland City Council President Kevin Kelly repurposed a political action fund he controls, or did control, to help in his bid for mayor instead of supporting all of his council colleagues? Leila Tassius is a story Courtney Astolfi worked on for a while. It's kind of astounding what Kevin Kelly's doing with this fund.
It really is. So we're talking about the Council Leadership Fund. It's this political action committee with the primary purpose of helping city council members get reelected. A lot of developers and lawyers and business type folk contribute to that PAC, and it's traditionally controlled by the city council president, who acts as the deputy treasurer. Some past council presidents have said that they, you know, disperse the money to any colleague who fell short on fundraising and needed a hand, but then others played favorites with it. You know, Marty Sweeney was kind of famous for that. But what we've seen this year is uniquely sketchy. Council President Kevin Kelly, who is running for mayor, has used it to fund the campaigns of pretty much only his colleagues who are on his leadership team or who have publicly endorsed him for mayor. So between June and late August, the PAC gave the maximum cash donation of $3,000 to Jasmine Santana, who's his majority whip, and Majority Leader Blaine Griffin, Kevin Bishop, Kevin Conwell, Dolores Gray, Brian Mooney, Tony Brancatelli. All of those have publicly endorsed him. And on top of cash donations, the PAC has paid more than $31,000 for yard signs and mailers and other literature for that group of council members. And the PAC also paid $45,000 for literature and advertisements for unspecified campaigns in records filed with the Board of Elections. Then, quietly, a couple weeks ago, Kelly did something that, as far as we can tell, is unprecedented in council history. He anointed Blaine Griffin as the new deputy treasurer in control of the PAC. Griffin wants to be the next council president. So does Councilman Kerry McCormick, who's backing Kelly's challenger Justin Bibb for mayor. So the question is, does having the power to fund council campaigns, you know, curry favor with Griffin's colleagues when it comes time for them to elect their next president? So just very interesting, you know, changing of hands of this powerful PAC.
I'm surprised that Blaine Griffin took it. That if Blaine Griffin wants to be the next council president, he has seen his colleagues kind of run against Kevin Kelly of late. They had to call a special meeting going around him because they were so upset with his lack of transparency and lack of movement on the stimulus money. And Blaine joined them. You know, he ended up signing on with them. But by taking control of that money from Kevin Kelly, he's pretty firmly aligning himself with Kevin Kelly. And depending on who wins in 2 weeks, he may not have the support to be council president. And he might be making some people that are unhappy with Kevin Kelly kind of angry.
Yep. I don't think there's any question that he's firmly aligned with Kevin Kelly. Like, that's, I think that he has chosen his course. He needs to stick with it at this point. But yeah, I am surprised also, because weeks and weeks ago, Courtney had asked him, we had heard rumors that he had already assumed control of the pack, that he was sort of, you know, he was in control of those purse strings. And she had asked him and he was like, no, I don't know what you're talking about. Any questions you have about the pack need to be directed to Kevin Kelly. He's in charge. And then quietly when this handover occurs, and Courtney didn't discover that until she was, you know, taking a look at the you know, filings of the pack and realized that a new deputy treasurer had been named. So given the high level of media interest in what's happening with this pack, I am kind of stunned that Blaine Griffin would have done this.
It's almost as if they're looking beyond this election year to the future. You know, if you talk to people in Kevin Kelly's orbit, there's almost a resignation that there's not really a path for him to win this thing. And so then what's next? Well, there's a county executive's race. And if the Bill Mason political machine, Bill Mason's been making calls on behalf of Armin Budish, he's his chief of staff. If that starts to get active again, you wonder whether this is all part of that. Like they're looking toward 2022 now because what they tried to pull off in 2021 failed.
That could very well be. That could be. I don't know what would lie ahead for Kevin Kelly. I mean, would this be the end of his political career?
Or
would he try to go ahead?
Or what if Armin Budish comes to his senses and realizes he has no way to get the support he's had in prior elections to win, and he drops out, which would really be the smart thing to do for him, because it's going to be a very ugly campaign if he's in it. Then Kevin Kelly could be almost the arm of the Mason political machine that steps in to challenge Chris Ronayne, who's already making a hard run at that. So I don't know. I mean, it's all up in the air. Armin Budish is going around putting the arm on people, trying to get them to support him. He's not finding, I don't believe, the financial support he's seen in the past. There are a whole lot of people just don't want him around anymore. The campaign will be brutal. I mean, just if you take the headlines from our site over the last 4 years, it would be a devastating campaign. There's so much incompetence there. So maybe they're looking at Kevin Kelly as a county executive candidate. Although, what do you think, Layla? I mean, it's almost like Kevin Kelly was a better candidate before he started campaigning. Since he started campaigning, there, we've learned things about him that are somewhat disturbing.
Yeah, and honestly, it's strange. He's been council president for so long, but we've learned that his name recognition within the city of Cleveland wasn't so great. Surprisingly, like no one even, you know, no one recognized who he was. How well recognized is he countywide? You know, that's the other question.
I think he's got more name recognition now than before, but it's not the kind of name recognition.
It's not the kind you want. That's exactly right. I'd love to see a Kevin Kelly, Chris Ronayne showdown, though. That would be great. I'd love to have us cover that.
That would give voters a real choice, which would be nice. A Chris Ronayne, Armin Budish campaign. It's just going to be ugly, and I think people would turn to Chris Ronayne in large numbers, even if the Mason political machine tried to exert its muscle again. You're listening to This Week in the CLE. What novel approach is Cuyahoga County taking to finding jail guards quickly to fill the depleted ranks? Lisa Garvin, got to give the county a big salute here. They finally have come up with something that seems like a very good idea.
Yes, they shortened the recruitment and application process. Typically, you know, nowadays they do it just in a month's time. They have several things they have to do, including drug screening, testing, background check, and all of that. But that's going to be shortened down to a mere 2 hours. They're going to have a hiring event this Wednesday, and they're going to do all of that. They're going to have the application, the testing, the background check, the interview. And if you pass all of those tests, you get a job offer on the spot. So they are really trying to speed things up. But it's getting kind of desperate there. I mean, they hope to hire at least 75 new corrections officers through this job fair. But they only have 550 officers right now at the jail, and they really are authorized for more than that, up to 725. So even if they get 75, they'll still be woefully short. But hey, I mean, if you can speed it up and if you can get good applicants, I think that's a great idea. I worry, though, how efficiently you can do a background check in just a couple of hours. That's just my only fear there.
Well, they can check the criminal record and things like that, but look, this seems like a way of getting a pipeline in a fast way. They're paying much better wages than they had in the past.
Right.
So if they say, come down, it's not going to take a month to get you in here. Come down, you know, if you've got the goods, we got the money. well, let's get moving. We'll have to see how it goes. They needed to do something bold, and at least they're trying something bold, whether or not it works.
But it does seem like
the jail is in.
Go ahead. No, I was just going to say, it seems like the pay raise made a big difference because, you know, before the pay raise took effect, it's now $24 an hour. Before that, they were only getting up to maybe 113 a month and as little as 38 applicants a month. But in September, after the pay raise was announced, it shot up to 230 people interested in applying. So obviously the pay did make a difference. But Adam Chalupka, he's with the Ohio Patrolman's Benevolent Association. He says that's great to get more officers, but they really need to improve working conditions there. So
yes, they absolutely,
absolutely
do. You're listening to This Week in the CLE. What did Ohio House Speaker Bob Cupp have to do to derail a renewed effort by a rogue legislator to prohibit vaccine mandates in the state? Laura Johnston, this just keeps coming back and coming back, and it keeps making Ohio look like a really backward state.
Yeah, this is, it just keeps coming. But Bob Cupp forced the Ohio House Health Committee Chair, Scott Lipps, to cancel a scheduled seventh hearing on Wednesday. This is after he told reporters it's time to move on to other more important topics. And then Lipps apparently has had anti-vaccine mandate protesters demonstrating outside his house, scheduled the hearing anyway, after Cupp basically said, we're done. So then he had to, you know, write a public letter that said, no, we are not doing this, cancel the hearing. Obviously, this is a controversial bill that would prohibit employers from requiring employees to be vaccinated, even though there are a ton of loopholes. This was supposed to be sailing right through after a compromise, after it came back from the summer, but it has had huge amounts of opposition from a rainbow of people, from conservative Republicans to liberal Democrats. There's nobody.
No, this is the old bill.
This was the old bill. Okay.
This is the one with the woman talking about the magnets. This isn't the compromise. He was trying to bring back the really draconian bill that has had nothing but lunatic testimony.
Okay, well, that's how confused I was about all of this stuff going on in Columbus. So, okay, this is the crazy one with the magnets then. But the other one hasn't really gotten anywhere either.
No, because he shelved it because he realized he can't get people to agree. I think this probably ends it, and they're going to leave it up to businesses to decide what they want to do, which used to be a Republican mantra. You're listening to This Week in the CLE. How does the story of a woman from Afghanistan spending a week in Cleveland provide insight into the bigger picture of refugees from that country? Lila Tassi, this was a sweet story that Hannah Drown put together about one person, but it is indicative of what is ahead for a whole lot of people.
It's true. Reporter Hannah Drown brought us this, I mean, just lovely, heartbreaking story about a 25-year-old Afghan refugee who she called Mersal in the story, though that's not her real name. In Afghanistan, she was working for a high-ranking government official when the Taliban regained control of the country in August, and her life was in imminent danger. I mean, they were searching for her. So she fled, leaving behind her sister and her mother. And through her government job, she had come to know an American, a Lorain County native, actually, named Jane Horton, who is a former senior Department of Defense official and also a Gold Star wife whose husband was killed in Afghanistan in 2011. And the two had kept in contact as the situation was unfolding in Afghanistan and the Taliban gained more power. So Horton eventually made the arrangements for Mersal's escape. And Mersal described for Hannah what it was like living through those days, seeing people who had been sleeping outside the airport for days in Kabul, waiting desperately for a flight out of the country. She ended up flying to Qatar on a military aircraft, where she and other refugees were just sitting in the stiflingly hot plane for hours. Women and children were fainting, and she eventually made it to an Air Force base in Germany, where she spent the next 8 days. So, you know, Mersal said it was, you know, 6 days before she had access to a shower, and there wasn't enough food for the thousands of refugees who were brought there. And she told Hannah about waiting in line for 4 hours for food, and by the time she reached the front of the line, there was nothing left. So eventually she made it to Virginia, where she connected with Horton and you know, finally was safe. But it's unclear what Mersal will do now. She's been staying in D.C. where Horton lives. And last week, and this is really what kind of caught our attention, was that Horton had brought her to Ohio, where she tick down a number of items on you know, a kind of a bucket list of things that she was never able to do in Afghanistan. She went horseback riding and apple picking and rode on a boat on Lake Erie. And she just enjoyed some very simple pleasures that many Westerners take for granted. And she told Hannah that she has felt so warmly received here, but she's just praying that her sister and mother can join her one day. And there's just so much uncertainty that lies ahead for her.
Well, what she described back in Afghanistan, where, the Taliban kept saying things will be different this time, but they very quickly have left women with almost zero rights. I mean, here, this is a woman who had a job working for the government. She felt like she had a vital cause, and now the women in that country have no rights. I mean, they're basically left into the bondage of men. And you feel for her. I mean, she had to get away. She worried about her family, but they said, get out of here, because she had worked for the government, made her somebody that could be in danger from the Taliban. But man, it's a tough road ahead for her.
It really is. It is. Yeah, I think she's back in D.C. now after her week in Ohio, and she's just trying to plot her path forward.
Okay, you're listening to This Week in the CLE. How much money did the candidates for the U.S. Senate in Ohio raise in the most recent reporting period? And who has the most money in the bank? Lisa Garvin, we can't answer this definitively because there were a couple people that didn't officially report when we looked at this on Friday, but we have a lot. What do we know?
Well, and there are a lot of numbers to crunch here, so I'm going to approach it on who has the most cash on hand, and then we'll go from there. Now, Josh Mandel was one of those two that did not file by the Friday deadline, but he did have a press release that day saying that he had $5.8 million on hand. That makes him number one, and he raised $1.1 million in the last quarter. Coming in second is Bernie Moreno, Cleveland businessman. He has $4.74 million cash on hand. He raised about $700,000 in the last quarter, but that was down quite significantly from previous quarters. He also loaned himself $3 million. So, and we have quite a few candidates have loaned themselves money. Number three, Mike Gibbons, he has $4.2 million cash on hand, but he made a $2.25 million loan to himself in the last quarter, and that's a total of $9 million that he's loaned to his campaign. Number four is Tim Ryan, one of the Democratic candidates. He has $3.6 million cash on hand. He says he raised $2.5 million in the last quarter. Number five is Jane Timken. She was also another who didn't report, but this is like an earlier release about her finances. She wrote herself a $1 million check. She raised $1.7 million in the last quarter. She has $3.1 million on hand. So, you know, but interesting, the ones who had to loan themselves money had lower donors. Like Jane Timken only had about $700,000 in donor money in the last quarter. So some people are opening up their pockets to finance their campaign.
We keep talking about this, and we'll be pursuing some content on it, but with so many people in, with so much money, they all have pretty much the same platform. How are people going to choose from between them? I mean, and we're going to be looking at the different strategies they're employing, but it's going to be a lot of messaging done based on a lot of money. When that many people are putting that many millions in, we're going to be barraged by messaging. It'd be interesting to see how that goes.
And I forgot to mention J.D. Vance. I'm sorry, I forgot. Who can forget J.D. Vance, the big flip-flopper? No, he raised $1.75 million. He has less than $1 million cash on hand, but apparently there's like $10 million in seed money from a super PAC. So I don't know exactly how that seed donation works, but he can rely on that $10 million.
And every time he opens his mouth, he seems to say something loonier than he has said before. It's very strange, the transformation of J.D. Vance from the guy we met back in 2016. You're listening to This Week in the CLE. What is the most popular vehicle in Ohio, and what are the top five? Laura Johnston, this is always kind of interesting to look at.
Yes. So the Ford F-150 pickup truck is the most popular vehicle in Ohio. I doubt it's the most popular vehicle in Cleveland, but we don't have those numbers right now. The Ohio Bureau of Motor Vehicles issued 31,168 titles for F-150 owners in 2020. Nobody else got nearly as much. And This is a domestic auto state. Honda is the only foreign brand that cracked the top 10. Mostly a Ford F-150 is the number one, Chevy Silverado second, and then we get a Honda Civic for
that. You know, what's interesting is that pickup trucks are the top two spots a large amount, and that there's only three brands in there, that you have Ford with four and Chevy and Honda with three each. And that one took me by a bit of a surprise. I didn't realize, one, that Ohio was such big Chevy country. It's not surprising that Honda does well because we do have a plant here, but the pickup truck, the F-150, you know, that's not an inexpensive vehicle either. That's a pretty pricey vehicle. It's surprising. And how many were there? There were 38,000 of them?
31,000. And the next one was 28,000. So it'll be interesting to see these for 2021 when cars have been harder to buy. But it looks, you know, obviously there are a couple really down months in 2020, but we sold, people are buying cars.
Yeah,
they're buying trucks specifically.
Yeah, it's an interesting list. You're listening to This Week in the CLE. Why is the Cleveland City Planning Commission excited about plans for the West 25th Street corridor? Leila Tassi, Steve Litt put together a story on these interlocking plans that could transform that neighborhood, building off of what MetroHealth is doing to revamp its entire campus.
Yeah, and that's exactly why the commissioners are so excited about it. They say that if done correctly, this really could be transformational. The plans are called 25 Together and Clark Fulton Connects, and they were designed by Metro West Community Development Organization and the Greater Cleveland Regional Transit Authority. And they're focused on what's known as transit-oriented development, and that's creating higher density, mixed-use development next to transit lines to encourage ridership and investment and economic activity. But they also want to maintain housing affordability and avoid displacing residents. Balancing those needs will really be the key to success here. So these plans were created to capitalize on the billion-dollar MetroHealth development project that's underway. They're, of course, working on transforming that campus into a, you know, hospital within a park rather than the closed-off fortress that it has been for decades. The transit-oriented development plan would turn West 25th Street into a West Side version of the Euclid Avenue Health Line, which RTA says has supported or helped inspire something like $9.5 billion worth of investment since 2008. And this would involve creating higher quality, more attractive, safer bus stations along West 25th. And it would improve the efficiency and speed of service through dedicated bus lanes and improve traffic signals along the route. And they would call this the MetroHealth line. The Clark Fulton plan, which is that interlocking plan, envisions enhancing a 1 square mile neighborhood in the center of all that as the vibrant heart of Cleveland's growing Hispanic community. And the plan calls for enhanced cultural facilities and parks and public spaces, safe bike routes and greenways, and programs that would help locally owned businesses, each with its own, you know, in these parts of neighborhood that all have their own distinctive character and housing types and things like that. You know, all of this, the MetroHealth line, they expect it could be done as soon as 2026, and it would cost $40 million to $60 million, and that would probably be paid for largely with federal grants and some other sources. But generally, the Planning Commission was super impressed by this. Go ahead.
There was one element of it that I always question. They want to make sure that we don't have gentrification that drives longtime residents out. Mm-hmm. And they have strategies that would limit the amount that property appraisals could rise in a period. But, you know, property appraisals are one thing. Capitalism's another. If this becomes an in-demand neighborhood, the value of those properties won't have anything to do with their appraisal. It'll have to do with what people are willing to pay for them. And unless they really put in low-income housing that is managed by somebody that is going to maintain it as low-income housing, almost a government function, I don't see how you can stop gentrification of that neighborhood.
That's true. You know, Steve mentioned something in the story about how, you know, tax abatement offerings often, you know, shift the tax burden to, you know, people who have been living there, you know, for a long time. And you know, that seems to be one way that they could, you know, prevent gentrification is to, you know, limit the use of abatement programs. But yeah, you're right. You know, when property values rise, how do you stop that runaway train?
Yeah, I don't, unless you actually have a CMHA housing complex there or something. I just don't know how you do it. Interesting story by Steve Litt. Check it out on cleveland.com. You're listening to This Week in the CLE, and that does it for a Monday. Come back tomorrow for another discussion of the news. Thanks, Laura. Thanks, Layla. Thanks, Lisa. Thank you for listening to this podcast.